This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Man Alive by G.K. Chesterton. Section 10, Part 1, The Enigmas of Innocent Smith. Chapter 5, The Allegorical Practical Joker. Part 2. "Oh, but there were two curates," cried Mary, with a certain eagerness. "That was what made it so much funnier." The darkened glass doors of the house opened once more, and Inglewood appeared for an instant, making a sort of signal. The American doctor bowed, the English doctor did not, but they both set out stolidly toward the house. No one else moved, not even Michael, hanging on the gate. But the back of his head and shoulders had still an indescribable indication that he was listening to every word. "But don't you understand, Mary," cried Rosamund in despair. "Don't you know that awful things have happened even before our very eyes? I should have thought you would have heard the revolver shot upstairs." "Yes, I heard the shot," said Mary, almost brightly, "but I was busy packing just then. An innocent had told me he was going to shoot at Dr. Warner, so it wasn't worth while to come down." "Oh, I don't understand what you mean," cried Rosamund Hunt, stamping. "But you must and shall understand what I mean. I don't care how cruelly I put it, if only I can save you. I mean that your innocent Smith is the most awfully wicked man in the world. He has sent bullets at lots of other men, and gone off in cabs with lots of other women, and he seems to have killed the women too, for nobody can find them." "He is really rather naughty sometimes," said Mary Gray, laughing softly as she buttoned her old gray gloves. "Oh, this is really mesmerism or something," cried Rosamond, and burst into tears. At the same moment the two black-clad doctors appeared out of the house with their great green-clad captive between them. He made no resistance, but was still laughing in a groggy and half-witted style. Arthur Inglewood followed in the rear, a dark and red study in the last shades of distress and shame. In this black, funereal, and painfully realistic style, the exit from Beacon House was made by a man whose entrance a day before had been affected by the happy leaping of a wall and the hilarious climbing of a tree. No one moved of the groups in the garden except Mary Gray, who stepped forward quite naturally, calling out, "Are you ready, Innocent? Our cab's been waiting for such a long time." "Ladies and gentlemen," said Dr. Warner firmly, "I must insist on asking this lady to stand aside. We shall have trouble enough as it is with the three of us in a cab." "But it is our cab," persisted Mary. "Why, there's Innocent's yellow bag on the top of it." "Stand aside," repeated Warner roughly. "And you, Mr. Moon, please be so obliging as to move a moment. Come, come, the sooner this ugly business is over, the better, and how can we open the gate if you will keep leaning on it?" Michael Moon looked at his long, lean forefinger, and seemed to consider and reconsider this argument. "Yes," he said at last, "but how can I lean on the gate if you keep opening it?" "Oh, get out of the way," cried Warner almost good-humouredly. "You can lean on the gate any time." "No," said Moon reflectively. "Seldom the time and place and the blue gate altogether. And it all depends whether you come of an old country family. My ancestors leaned on gates before anyone had discovered how to open them." "Michael," cried Arthur Inglewood in a kind of agony, "are you going to get out of that way?" "Why, no, I think not," said Michael, after some meditation, and swung himself slowly round so that he confronted the company, while still in a lounging attitude occupying the path. "Hello!" he called out suddenly. "What are you doing to Mr. Smith?" "Taking him away," answered Warner shortly, "to be examined." "Matriculation?" asked Moon brightly. "By a magistrate," said the other curtly. "And what other magistrate," cried Michael, raising his voice, "dares to try what befell on this free soil, save only the ancient and independent Dukes of Beacon? What other court dares to try one of our company, save only the High Court of Beacon? Have you forgotten that only this afternoon we flew the flag of independence and severed ourselves from all the nations of the earth." "Michael," cried Rosamund, wringing her hands, "how can you stand there talking nonsense? Why, you saw the dreadful thing yourself. You were there when he went mad. It was you that helped the doctor up when he fell over the flower pot." "And the High Court of Beacon," replied Moon with hauteur, "has special powers in all cases concerning lunatics, flower pots, and doctors who fall down in gardens. It is our very first charter from Edward the First. Si medicus quisquam in horto prostratus." "Out of the way," cried Warner with sudden fury, "or we will force you out of it." "What," cried Michael Moon with a cry of hilarious fierceness, "shall I die in defence of this sacred pale? Will you paint these blue railings red with my gore?" And he laid hold of one of the blue spikes behind him. As Inglewood had noticed earlier in the evening, the railing was loose and crooked at this place, and the painted iron staff and spearhead came away in Michael's hand as he shook it. "See," he cried, brandishing this broken javelin in the air, "the very lances round Beacon Tower leap up from their places to defend it. Ah, in such a place and hour, it is a fine thing to die alone." And in a voice like a drum he rolled the noble lines of Ronsard. "Sakes alive," said the American gentleman, almost in an awed tone. Then he added, "Are there two maniacs here?" "No, there are five," thundered Moon. "Smith and I are the only sane people left." "Michael," cried Rosamund, "Michael, what does it mean?" "It means bosh," roared Michael, and slung his painted spear, hurtling to the other end of the garden. "It means that doctors are bosh, and criminology is bosh, and Americans are bosh, much more bosh than our Court of Beacon. It means, you fatheads, that Innocent Smith is no more mad or bad than the bird on that tree." "But, my dear Moon," began Inglewood in his modest manner, "these gentlemen—" "On the word of two doctors," exploded Moon again, without listening to anybody else. "Shut up in a private hell on the word of two doctors, and such doctors! Oh, my hat, look at 'em! Do just look at 'em! Would you read a book, or buy a dog, or go to a hotel on the advice of 20 such? My people came from Ireland and were Catholics. What would you say if I called a man wicked on the word of two priests?" "But it isn't only their word, Michael," reasoned Rosamund. "They've got evidence, too." "Have you looked at it?" asked Moon. "No," said Rosamund, with a sort of faint surprise. "These gentlemen are in charge of it." "And of everything else, it seems to me," said Michael. "Why, you haven't even had the decency to consult Mrs. Duke." "Oh, but that's no use," said Diana, in an undertone to Rosamund. "And he can't say boo to a goose." "I'm glad to hear it," answered Michael, "for with such a flock of geese to say it to, the horrid expletive might be constantly on her lips. For my part, I simply refuse to let things be done in this light and airy style. I appeal to Mrs. Duke. It's her house." "Mrs. Duke," repeated Inglewood doubtfully. "Yes, Mrs. Duke," said Michael firmly, "commonly called the Iron Duke." "If you ask Auntie," said Diana quietly, "she'll only be for doing nothing at all. Her only idea is to hush things up or let things slide. That just suits her." "Yes," replied Michael Moon, "and as it happens, it just suits all of us. You are impatient with your elders, Miss Duke, but when you are as old yourself, you will know what Napoleon knew, that half one's letters answer themselves, if you can only refrain from the fleshly appetite of answering them." He was still lounging in the same absurd attitude, with his elbow on the grate, but his voice had altered abruptly for the third time, just as it had changed from the mock heroic to the humanly indignant. It now changed to the airy incisiveness of a lawyer giving good legal advice. "It isn't only your aunt who wants to keep this quiet, if she can," he said. "We all want to keep it quiet, if we can. Look at the large facts, the big bones of the case. I believe those scientific gentlemen have made a highly scientific mistake. I believe Smith is as blameless as a buttercup. I admit buttercups don't often let off loaded pistols in private houses. I admit there is something demanding of explanation, but I am morally certain There is some blunder, or some joke, or some allegory, or some accident behind all this. Well, suppose I'm wrong. We've disarmed him. We're five men to hold him. He may as well go to a lock-up later on as now. But suppose there's even a chance of my being right. Is it in anybody's interest to wash this linen in public? Come, I'll take each of you in order. Once take Smith outside that gate, and you take him into the front page of the evening papers. I know. I've written the front page myself, Miss Duke. Do you or your aunt want a sort of notice stuck up over your boarding-house? Doctors shot here? No, no. Doctors are rubbish, as I said. But you don't want the rubbish shot here. Arthur, suppose I am right, or suppose I am wrong. Smith has appeared as an old school fellow of yours. Mark my words, if he's proved guilty, the organs of public opinion will say you introduced him. If he's proved innocent, they will say you helped to collar him. Rosamund, my dear, suppose I am right or wrong. If he is proved guilty, they'll say you engaged your companion to him. If he's proved innocent, they'll print that telegram. I know the organs, damn them. He stopped an instant, for this rapid rationalism left him more breathless than had either his theatrical or his real denunciation. But he was plainly in earnest, as well as positive and lucid, as was proved by his proceeding quickly the moment he had found his breath. "It is just the same," he cried, "with our medical friends. You will say that Dr. Warner has a grievance. I agree. But does he want specially to be snapshotted by all the journalists, prostratus in horto? It was no fault of his, but the scene was not very dignified even for him. He must have justice. But does he want to ask for justice, not only on his knees, but on his hands and knees? Does he want to enter the court of justice on all fours? Doctors are not allowed to advertise, and I'm sure no doctor wants to advertise himself as looking like that. And even for our American guest, the interest is the same. Let us suppose that he has conclusive documents. Let us assume that he has revelations really worth reading. Well, in a legal inquiry, or a medical inquiry for that matter, 10 to 1 he won't be allowed to read them. He'll be tripped up every 2 or 3 minutes with some tangle of old rules. A man can't tell the truth in public nowadays, but he can still tell it in private, and he can tell it inside that house. It is quite true, said Dr. Cyrus Pym, who had listened throughout the speech with a seriousness which only an American could have retained through such a scene. It is true that I have been perceptibly less hampered in private inquiries. Dr. Pym, cried Warder in a sort of sudden anger, Dr. Pym, you aren't really going to admit. End of section 10.